Hello, I'm Ellen Bintz, coming today from Wheaton, Illinois in the USA. Welcome to Impact, a podcast about how we can each bring about real change in the world and getting practical in making that happen.
And hello, I'm Clive Johnson, coming today from Leigh-on-Sea, Essex in the UK. A special welcome if you're listening for the first time, and a big thank you to our new subscribers. Each week, we look at one aspect of how we can connect our hearts to offer healing for others with our collective intention, prayers, and meditation, and go behind the headlines of a critical happening in our world that needs our attention right now.
In today's episode, we take one of these regular deep dives to more fully understand and tune in with something many of us may know only a little about, and see where we might hone in with our prayers and intentions. And as we record, it is May 8th, 2024. So, prominent in the news in the U.S. and now elsewhere in the world at the moment are the protests that are currently taking place on numerous campuses across the United States, especially in response to the ongoing conflict in Gaza. And it's on this theme that we focus our attention today. As always, our aim is not to take political sides on what is a very polarized issue, but to understand what's happening and why, and in turn to see where we can focus our prayers and intentions.
So let's first of all remind ourselves of the situation in Gaza that has prompted much of the protesting. So, as I'm sure listeners will know, or most listeners will know, Israel was invaded last October the 7th by Hamas and other Palestinian militia groups who stormed over Gaza's border into Israel, killed about 1,200 people, and abducted 252 civilians, some of whom have since been freed. In response, Israel launched a deadly attack on Gaza, where it says Hamas leaders are hiding, and vowed to eliminate the group entirely. Its continued operation has come under increasing international criticism, as many see that the killing and suffering of hundreds of thousands of ordinary people in Gaza has been disproportionate and contravened internationally recognized rules of engagement for war. Aid agencies have had difficulty functioning in the region, with one, Médecins Sans Frontières, saying that Israeli authorities are maintaining full control over the entry and exit points into Gaza. The World Food Programme says that more than 1 million Palestinians in Gaza are experiencing catastrophic hunger, while a growing sanitation crisis threatens the spread of disease for those sheltering in makeshift camps. As of this weekend, nearly 35,000 Palestinians are believed to have been killed by Israeli forces since the start of the war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue the war until its goals are achieved. And at the same time, Hamas has continued firing rockets into Israel. Both sides have reached temporary ceasefires at times during the conflict, including the reopening of a land border to Gaza for humanitarian purposes. And in fact, that is happening as we recall today. We understand that Israel has reopened one of the borders that had been closed. However, the ability to supply international aid has been heavily frustrated by the limited access and extensive controls placed on goods entering the region. At the time of recording, hope of a move towards a new 40-day ceasefire seemed to be fading, as Israel has signaled its intention to launch an offensive on the southern garden city of Rafah, warning citizens there to leave. And indeed, again, as we record, there is a military action within Gaza. Within Israel itself, there are some tensions within the Netanyahu government, which have been reported, while many families of Israeli hostages remaining in Gaza are calling upon their government to prioritize the safe return of the hostages above all else.
So what has been happening at U.S. campuses in recent weeks? Recent protests have seen demonstrators setting up encampments on more than 80 campuses across the U.S. The flashpoint that mobilized such widespread demonstrations was the arrest of over 100 student demonstrators at Columbia University in New York in mid-April, where students had set up a Gaza solidarity encampment on the same day as the university's president, Manoush Shafiq, told the U.S. Congress that she will protect Jewish students from a moral crisis of anti-Semitism. New York police moved in on 18th of April to conduct the arrests at Shafiq's request. Prior to the Columbia University arrests, student protests had started to appear at some campuses earlier in the war. While there were some troubling incidents of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, the protests overall were neither anti-Semitic nor violent. Protests have seen police making arrests and university leaders threatening disciplinary action at campuses ranging from Yale, where students who are arrested have been threatened with suspension from the elite university, Harvard, which has already initiated disciplinary action against nearly 40 students and student workers, the University of Florida, University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, and UCLA being among others who've said that anyone who blocks classrooms could face expulsion or suspension. Portland State University in Oregon has gone further, saying that protesters who occupied its library steps and disabled the library from use have crossed into criminal behavior and will be prosecuted. Arrests have also occurred at Princeton, the University of Connecticut, University of Texas at Austin, Virginia Tech, and more. Graduation ceremonies have been temporarily postponed at many institutions.
In some campuses, clashes between rival pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli groups have become violent. For example, at UCLA last Wednesday, masked attackers used metal pipes and pepper spray in their confrontation. At Columbia, as elsewhere, Jewish students say that they have been blocked from areas of campus due to the protests. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson has said that anti-Semitism is a virus and suggests that U.S. military reserve forces should be brought in to restore order. Columbia later began suspending pro-Palestinian student activists from their encampment. Having said that, most of the demonstrations have been peaceable, but it is the clashes with police, particularly at Columbia University, Portland State, and UCLA, which have captured media and public attention. Some have seen the response from university administrations and law enforcement as being heavy-handed, as police have arrested more than 2,000 people at U.S. campuses since April the 18th. These arrests have often served to encourage others to regroup. Demonstrations have also been happening on campuses in parts of Europe. I know here in the UK this week, there are encampments set up at Oxford and Cambridge, for example, in Asia, Canada, and the Middle East, including encampments between rival protesters on the grounds of universities in Brisbane and Sydney in France, and also close to Israel's borders in Lebanon, some inspired by what has been happening in the US, if not all inspired. I don't think we really know the situation there, but clearly this is growing.
Yeah. And what are they protesting about? The demands among protesters vary and include pro-Israel supporters, as well as those opposing the Netanyahu government policy. The majority claim, in the words of one protester, to uplift the voices of Gazans, of Palestinians facing genocide, calling for their institutions to divest from companies that support Israel and the war in Gaza, or do business with Israel. Many schools have massive endowments funding everything from research projects to scholarships. One student protester at the American University of Beirut told Reuters, "We want to show the whole world that we have not forgotten the Palestinian cause and that the young generation, which is aware and cultured, is still with the Palestinian cause." Lobbying their schools to divest isn't new. For example, at Columbia, some protesters belong to the coalition CUAD, which formed in 2016 to demand their institution disclose investments in and divest and stop investing in Israel and American companies and institutions that support Israel. The coalition's demands are aligned with BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, a movement started by Palestinian civil society groups in 2005. CUAD also calls for an immediate ceasefire from government officials, including President Joe Biden, and to cease a dual degree program that Columbia has with Tel Aviv University. Critics say that BDS and anti-Zionism are anti-Semitic, delegitimize Israel, and effectively reject or ignore the Jewish people's right of self-determination. Analysts say that divestment would have a negligible impact on the war in Gaza. Nonetheless, it may serve to draw attention to those organizations that align with Israel.
So it's so easy to see, isn't it, why the feelings are so strong here. There's such a deep-rooted sense of injustice on both sides, really, or this need for what they see as appropriate action. And clearly, this is not something new. It's just the scale of it and the fact that the encampments have taken root and they're blocking access to other students and so on. So are the protests anti-Semitic? Well, in truth, the picture is quite mixed as far as we can tell from news reports. For many students, their argument is against the strength of power that Israel has launched against ordinary Palestinians in response to the October 7th attack. Few would see Hamas as being other than it is portrayed by most media and governments as a terrorist organization, and few would describe themselves as being anti-Semitic, or say that they have any argument with ordinary Israelis or Jewish people as a whole. However, this is not invariably the case, and of course there will be perhaps a minority who are generally anti-Semitic and are really tagging on to this, what's happening. There have been isolated incidents of anti-Semitic rhetoric and behavior by a small number of protesters, yet the majority of the students say that they value every human life and that all identity-based hatred is at odds with liberation. They have condemned the use of inflammatory language and violence. And some Jewish student groups too, including those supporting a ceasefire in Gaza, have said it is unacceptable to conflate criticism of Israel's government with anti-Semitism, as this only serves to obfuscate real cases of anti-Semitism.
And what is the nature of pro-Israel protesters at U.S. campuses? Well, there have been counter-protests, of course, by pro-Israel supporters at some campuses where Palestinian protests have taken place, such as UCLA. And these counter-protests have occasionally involved violence, as we mentioned. The response from authorities to these pro-Israel counter-protests has been criticized by Gaza, supporting students as being more lenient compared to the crackdowns on the pro-Palestinian protests. For example, at UCLA, no arrests were made after the pro-Israel counter-protesters attacked the pro-Palestinian encampment, drawing criticism from Muslim advocacy groups. The pro-Israel protests have included participation from far-right Christian nationalist groups in addition to pro-Israel supporters. For example, at Columbia University, a March for Israel protest saw the involvement of far-right Christian nationalists alongside pro-Israel demonstrators.
And how are Jewish students in the U.S. feeling about the protests on their campuses? Jewish students on U.S. college campuses are feeling a range of complex and conflicting emotions in response to the recent wave of protests. Many Jewish students feel fearful, unsafe, and unwelcome on their campuses, this is what they're telling journalists, due to the presence of anti-Israel and perceived anti-Semitic rhetoric and imagery. Some have reported hiding their Jewish identity or religious symbols out of fear of retaliation. Some Jewish students have expressed anger and frustration at what they see as tolerance or acceptance of anti-Semitic incidents and rhetoric at the protests, with some feeling that their concerns are being ignored. Others are hesitant to counter-protest out of concern for their safety. However, there are also Jewish students who support the right to protest and want to show empathy for both Palestinians and Israelis affected by the conflict. In response, some Jewish groups are organizing rallies to demonstrate solidarity with Jewish students and show there is room for nuanced perspectives.
So what has been the response of institutions, politicians, and others? Well, the response to the protests from university administrations and law enforcement has raised concerns about the suppression of free speech and the right to peaceful assembly, with some critics arguing that the heavy-handed response of university chiefs and police have only served to draw more attention to the protests and increase their momentum. Universities have struggled to balance their goals of protecting free speech and combating anti-Semitism since the outbreak of the war, which has proved a political minefield. In December, Three university presidents who testified before Congress were accused of being too permissive of free speech in the face of anti-Semitism or being too legalistic in their explanations of their situation. Now some universities seem to be changing their tactic. Columbia's long-standing reputation as a bastion of free speech has been called into question following its decision to bring in police. Meanwhile, the University of Southern California, USC, recently canceled its graduation ceremony over campus safety concerns. The protests are coinciding with graduation ceremonies and commencements across the country, with various adjustments being made. At the University of Vermont, for example, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, will no longer deliver the commencement address following calls for the school to rescind its invitation.
Nonetheless, universities are taking different approaches in response to the protests. Some are negotiating with student activists, while others are continuing to issue ultimatums and turning to the police for support. Columbia University's President Shafiq says that the school will not divest from Israeli companies or those that contribute to the ongoing occupation and destruction of Gaza, but has offered a process to make Columbia's investments more transparent and pledged to support every childhood development in Gaza. President Joe Biden has tried to tread a delicate tightrope in his response, both affirming the right to protest, but, as he says, not the right to cause chaos. It's against the law when violence occurs, he said in a recent White House address. The president has previously denounced both anti-Semitic protests and those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians. Meanwhile, Biden is facing pressure from Republicans to more forcefully speak out on the protests, with Republican Senator Tom Cotton asking last Wednesday, when will the president himself, not his mouthpieces, condemn these hate-filled little Gazas? James Clyburn, a Democratic congressman from South Carolina, has also expressed concerns about how the protests may impact Biden's second-term presidential run, agreeing with Senator Bernie Sanders that Biden's stance over Israel's war in Gaza may have alienated younger voters. The protests do appear to be achieving some of their goals, with agreements made at Brown University, the University of Southern California, and Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, just down the road from you, Eleanor.
Mm-hmm.
For example, on April 30th, Brown University students agreed to stand down their camp following a vote by university trustees to divest from firms supporting Israel. Elsewhere, agreement to disband another encampment at the University of California, Riverside, UCR, followed university administration and protesters reaching agreement over investment transparency and study abroad programs. A compromise was also reached between Northwestern University near Chicago that limits the size of protesters' encampment.
So why is this situation so polarized? The protests have polarized differences of view, heightened concerns about anti-Semitic and anti-Islamic hate speech and action, and challenged the question of what the limits to freedom of speech should be. The protests have also polarized political positions in what is already a highly polarized society. The nature of this is demonstrated in a recent article by Professor of International Affairs at the University of Georgia, Cass Muda. According to Muda, the far right has portrayed universities as hotbeds of terrorist sympathizers and wokeness that threaten core American values like freedom of speech. In far right propaganda, universities are the dystopian future of the whole country, where women, non-whites, and LGBTQ plus people oppress real Americans, i.e. white Christian conservatives. Even the iconic NBC show Saturday Night Live featured a sketch in its most recent airing highlighting the question of whether students should be back behind their desks, at least from the point of view of those parents who are funding their education. Yet, a Scientific American article penned by sociologist Braden King reflects on the vibrancy of a younger generation's voicing its views. As has been the case many times since the rise of McCarthyism and later protests focused on civil rights, women's equality, opposition of the Vietnam War, Black Lives Matter, among others. It makes sense that campuses seethe with protest, he says. Universities and colleges give students a liberal education focused on critical thinking, broadening their perspectives, and emphasizing the importance of ideas in our lives. And as research on activism has demonstrated, young people simply have more time, energy, and flexibility to dedicate to activism, especially when compared to their slightly older full-time employee peers. The question many are pondering is how much freedom to speak and protest is acceptable when the safety of others who aren't directly the focus of the protests are compromised.
I love that quote, actually, from Braden King there. What are universities about? But then this is clearly one of the big debates, isn't it, really, that there are responsibilities in having freedom. So then, where might we focus our intention? Deciding what is acceptable and in accordance with the principles of free speech and the right to protest, and what crosses the line into threatening the safety of others, incites hatred, and puts unreasonable pressure on authorities to maintain order, not to mention the universities in providing an education, is a difficult judgment for any free society. Given this difficulty, we suggest holding as our intention this week. We will, that university presidents, trustees, and others in positions of influence will be guided in their responses to the protests on their campuses. Please join us in holding this. Possibly one of the most difficult decisions I imagine many of those in those positions of authority will have. I think President Shafiq at Columbia said that in something I read. This has been one of the most difficult calls, essentially. Bringing in the police is not taken lightly, I don't think. Whether some have reacted too quickly or not, whether different strategies working are going to work in different institutions. I kind of feel, I think it was Northwestern University near you that has this limit on encampments we mentioned. Sounds possibly like a compromised kind of thing. You know, you can process, right. There's ways of processing, but remember, you know, no hate speech. And there's ways of protesting, which
I'm thinking back to our episode with Brother Dave, where we talked about, you know, what to do when bad things happen. And he spoke about demonstration that he went to with Thich Nhat Hanh and some other Buddhist monks, and they were peaceful, and yes. How impactful that was to everyone who was there.
Yes.
And, you know, my work with the Legacy Labyrinth Project and contemplative labyrinth activism, and my tagline is powerful change can happen peacefully.
Yes. Yes.
And I you know, this could be a place where that could, you know, that could be implemented. And I do hope that the police don't get overzealous. You know, if something is peaceful, I agree that they can't block the steps of the library and they can't put other students in jeopardy. And I know there can't be chaos, but, you know, I wonder if allowing them to gather is okay. I'm not in charge. Thankfully,
Exactly. So. there's certain times when you have a protest and your voice is going to be heard and you're going to get the media attention. Possibly in some cases, you're going to be successful in lobbying politicians and others, university, you know, those that make these funding decisions. But there is also the responsibility. There's getting this balance, allowing those students who are not active in the protest, perhaps on either side, to be able to get to the library is important. That's responsibility of universities as well. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very, very difficult, I think, to get right.
I do have tremendous empathy for the Jewish students and all Jewish citizens, really, right now. I understand their fear and concerns. And my hope is that we can tease out what needs to be protested about. And, you know, like you said, most people do see that it's just the quote unquote genocide that's happening in Palestine that people are protesting and not Jewish people.
And where the demonstration, you know, when you have a very strong view and you, there is a channel, a platform for protesting, sometimes it can get quickly misaligned and out of portion. That's where this polarity starts to happen. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the wrong people get targeted. So it is ordinary Jewish students. There's some of the Islamophobia as well, of course, you know, who many of whom may not agree with the Israeli government or have any, you know, strong view on that, at least, about what is going on. As we've said, there are Jewish students who are in solidarity with peacefire, call for peacefire.
Right. Not,
they all kind of then get branded by those who polarize on the other side, or many of those on the other side, as being culpable, as, you know, the Netanyahu government. It reminds me of a good friend of mine, actually, whose son is Palestinian, and for many years she's been very prominent in leading demonstrations for the Palestinian cause, which, you know, many people will have sympathy for. But I do remember a situation where they were successful in a lobby of a shop. It was in my old home city of Brighton, to close. And this shop was sourcing goods from an Israeli company. I think a company had built on the West Bank. I'm not entirely sure. It had a factory on the West Bank. So it was the company that the shop that was money's different suppliers was taking goods from the supplier. Was there were protests outside for months and months. I do remember them. There's quite a prominent street in Brighton, and eventually it had to close. Mm-hmm. And the guy went out of business. And I thought, well, have you really directed your? And what's this achieved?
Right.
You just put one person out of business. It's not done anything in terms of really damaging that company, the supplier, or lobbying politicians. So how energy is channeled, how our process is channeled, is something that I don't know. Sometimes it gets lost, I think. We see it here as well, the environmental protesters sticking themselves to motorways and things like this. There are ways of getting strong public attention and media attention that don't endanger lives and don't really cause actually the opposite effect of what you're achieving when you start to alienate people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wisdom and discernment is needed.
Indeed. Indeed, indeed.
Well, that about wraps it up for this episode. Remember, you can connect with us in the Facebook group and for live intention holding in Clive's Daily Insight Timer offerings and with me in the Labyrinth Activist Network's Zoom calls. Details of how to hook up with these are in our show notes. Look out, too, for our next special topic episode, which we'll be releasing in the next few days. Thank you for listening and for sharing with us in holding intentions. We look forward to connecting again next time. And in the meantime,
thank you. Go well, stay safe.
And remember, we're more powerful together.
Impact is presented by Ellen Mintz and Clive Johnson and produced by Impact Productions. Our theme music is by Chris Collins and our logo artwork is by Auto Classic. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, or your favorite podcast provider. We're a non-commercial podcast dedicated to people of any faith tradition or none who yearn for healing in our troubled world. Please pass on the word so others may join us in making an impact. Thank you for listening.